are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, November 6, 2017. My name is Michael Brooks, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Alyssa Battistoni on Thriving, Not Surviving, Climate Change, the Environment, and Our Democratic Socialist Future. We'll be talking with her about the right way to respond to Trump's assault on the environment. BBC reporting on Paradise Papers, Tax Havens, The Secrets of the Ultra Rich, a consortium of more than 90 news organizations, has revealed that, shockingly, the globe's plutocrats don't pay their share of taxes. Who'd have thunk it?
Not fair.
Not fair. Ed Gillespie running a mini Trump, ultra bigoted xenophobic race for Virginia's gubernatorial race as people head to the polls tomorrow there and in New Jersey and in New York City. Will that model further entrench nativism and xenophobia in the GOP? Rand Paul got beat up by his neighbor. Very weird story. Saudi King is making moves on rival factions of the royal family under the guise of fighting corruption, and a very questionable helicopter accident takes out one of the Saudi royals. Trump in Japan essentially siding with Japanese ultra-far-right nationalists to restart Japanese military. And the way they should, of course, restart it is by buying weapons from us. And Trump wins about 70 visas to bring foreign workers as maids into Mar-a-Lago. And apparently, Robert Mueller might have enough intelligence, enough information to press charges against both Mike Flynn and Dad Mike Flynn Jr. as the perp walks hopefully continue as the OG Robert Mueller circles in on the Habsburg family meets Colombo, Habsburg dynasty meets Colombo family, the Trump administration. All that and more on today's Majority Report. Of course, there was this atrocity in Texas yesterday. As it stands now, 26 people were dead in a mass shooting at a mega church, at a church in rural Texas. The gunman is also dead. The victim's age ranges from 5 to 72. I had actually just read that the youngest might have been 18 months, according to updated information that I've seen. Obviously, this is, of course, not the time to talk about policy. It's a time to kind of sort of offer, prayers and then vague, random demonization of people who struggle with mental health issues. But as I always say, the way to frame this issue is that there is a domestic arms cartel in this country. There's an interest group that represents them. They have absolutely no regard, care, or concern for public safety or lives of any form. They are an incredibly dangerous, absolutely lives-discarding business. Their bagmen in the GOP are going to do whatever they want in Congress no matter what, because they're an own subsidiary of this dangerous cartel and the NRA that represents them. And this might essentially just boil down to this is going to need to be direct consumer action and mass public shame of anybody who profits from these industries. It's disgusting. This tragedy will make no difference from a policy standpoint, and obviously will make no difference in the conscience of any of the people that work in this industry. And that's really, I mean, we're going to play some more sound on this later, because obviously there was any number of insane and disgusting comments that were made about this. But, you know, that's the basic summary. There's an arms cartel, holds the country hostage. It has a frontline propaganda organization, the NRA, which is incredibly adroit at exploiting the racial paranoias, the fears, the xenophobia, the whole conspiracy lizard brain of Trump and Alex Jones and all the rest. And then there's the Republican Party, who both because of campaign contributions and a certain part of their voting base and a kind of national propaganda network are never going to do anything about it. So we got to focus on holding these companies directly accountable and mass public shaming their leadership, because they're all complicit. Let me actually, before we do that, do have some ads we have to get to. Well, no, you know what? We should have a palate cleanser before we do that. Donald Trump is in Japan, and they're laughing at us. They're literally laughing. Donald Trump is such an embarrassment that even people like me that don't place a whole lot of stock in, like, how are we being perceived overseas? Because the reality is that if we're engaging in awful policies overseas, there's only sort of so much that it can matter the sort of personal style of the president. But the fact that this guy is an incredible bloviating jackass on top of increasing civilian casualties in a place like Afghanistan does not help. These are images of Donald Trump with Shinzo Abe. We have the burger photo first. This is after they played golf. They're in Japan. And, of course, Donald Trump in Japan needs a Coke and a burger because he's an overgrown child with a mush brain.
Are you sure you don't want to eat with chapsticks, Shinzo?
Yeah, Shinzo, you want chapsticks? Chinky, 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 rice. But I'll have a burger. And then they have the him and Abe both have now the make alliances even greater signed hats. And Abe kind of has the sort of like, oh, God, this guy's a moron. North Korea might literally actually do something to my country. And this idiot is the one that I have to work with to figure this crisis out. So there is Trump in Asia, where he can tweet threats to murder millions of people in the Korean Peninsula and pick a fight with Steph Curry.
Very presidential.
Very presidential. It is, in fact, totally embarrassing. Blue Apron is number one in fresh ingredients and recipe delivery service in the country. Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. Blue Apron achieves this by supporting more sustainable food systems, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. Check out some of these featured upcoming meals. Crispy wild Alaskan pollock and garlic mashed potatoes with roasted broccoli and tartar sauce. Cheesy broccoli baked pasta with crispy thyme breadcrumbs. Seared steaks and garlic butter with oven fries and romaine salad. Roasted chicken and fall vegetable with cranberry and ginger compote. I have had a lot of Blue Apron meals, and I'm going to need to, I think I'm going to be moving soon. I'm going to have to get a Blue Apron membership. Every meal I've had with Blue Apron is unbelievably tasty and insanely easy to put together. Check out this week's menu and get 30 off of your first order with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/majority. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/majority. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. And as everybody knows from Sam's Kvetching, I've had to do a lot of traveling over the last month. And sometimes if I'm doing a work thing, you know, you're lucky and the flights and everything are booked and planned for you. But as you know, if you have to plan any sort of trip, it can be incredibly complicated to figure out. And did you know that the average family visits 5 websites before booking a vacation rental? Just think of the amount of time and agita that creates. You can spend less time planning your next trip and more time relaxing with Tripping.com, the world's number one site for vacation rentals. Whether you're looking for a cabin or a getaway for New Year's Eve, planning your next beach vacation in Hawaii, or that vacation in Europe where you'll live like a local, Trip.com can help you find the perfect place to stay. Vacation rentals offer flexibility, perks, and amenities that hotels don't, like multiple bedrooms, backyards, hot tubs, free Wi-Fi, and even a fully stocked kitchens. So you have a quick bite on the go or a plan and cook your own meals. Great for families and large groups. This sounds incredibly fun, actually. We should use Tripping to do like some type of Majority Report TMBS getaway to like Barbados or something. I'm sure we're all going to want to do that in February. Tripping.com, one search lets you filter and compare and sort out over 10 million available properties on trusted sites like Vrbo, like VRBO, TripAdvisor, Booking.com, and more. Don't wonder if you're getting the best deal. You'll save an average of 18% per night by booking your vacation with Tripping.com. So don't forget, if you want to save money while booking the perfect vacation rental for your next trip, head to Tripping.com/majority. That's TRIPPING.com/majority. Tripping.com/majority. And this is also very exciting. Our old friends Movement are back. I'm going to need to. Movement might lure me back into the watch game. I've seen Sam got his wife a watch. It's incredibly dope looking. The holiday shopping season is here. With Movement, you can skip the crowds and standing in crazy lines and find a gift that they'll love at prices that beat department stores. Movement watches start at just $95. At a department store, you're looking at $400 to $500. Movement figured out that by selling online, they are able to cut out the middleman and retail markup, providing the best possible price. At such great prices, Movement watches make wonderful holiday gifts too. Classic design, quality construction, and styled minimalism. Over 1 million watches sold in over 160 countries. Get 15% off today with free shipping and free returns by going to movement.com/majority. That's MVMT.com/majority. This watch has a really clean design that makes a great fashion statement. Now is the time to step up your watch game. Go to MVMT.com/majority. Join the movement. All right, everybody. We are going to take a brief break. We will be back with Alyssa Bastini, and we're going to be talking about climate and socialism.
So we just burn them evil concepts because we said that is a destruction to the humanity. So may I say? What about you now, Lord? Hey, check this. Sure.
Jaja City, Jaja Town, them want to turn it in a cowboy town. I want to look and know. Jaja City, Jaja Town, them want to turn it in a dead man town. Oi. Them think them reach the ultimate, yo, but them no reach nowhere yet. Oi, them get caught in the internet. Of society, I tell me them my intellect, them promote too much debt. Who no look and know? Jaja City, Jaja Town, them a turn it in a bad man town. Oi, who no look and know? Jaja City, Jaja Town, them want to turn it in a cowboy town. Oi, want to scare you soon. Love is the only solution, can stop a revolution. Just freedom and meditation from war and illusion. Love is the only solution, and can stop a revolution. Just freedom and meditation from war and illusion.
But Molly rise and gone on them, think we done. Tosh rise and gone on them, think we did done. Jacob Miller rise and gone, them think we did done.
Gone it silk him rise and gone. But look ya, Morgan family come rise. And many rise to our uprising. Sizzler rise. And many rise to his uprising. Luciano rise. And many rise to his uprising. Rastafari call we so we come. Mali children rise. And many rise to their uprising. Capleton rise. And David Oshu is uprising. Would you rise? And many rise to his uprising.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. Michael Brooks here. Joining us now is Alyssa Battistoni. She is on the editorial board of Jacobin Magazine. She's a PhD candidate in political science at Yale University, and she's the author of the recent piece, Living, Not Just Surviving. Working class movements must place social and ecological reproduction at the heart of their vision for the future. Alyssa, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Alyssa, I want to kind of start by, you talked about Donald Trump's pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord, which he did over the summer. And, you know, this sparked a lot of outrage and a lot of concern. I think, you know, for some pretty obvious reasons, because, you know, we were already sort of at a point where even the kind of mainstream ways of addressing this crisis were really insufficient, and he was sort of committed to sort of accelerating, not dealing with the issue, you know, sort of in the opposite direction, putting us into kind of full reverse gear. But you kind of made the point that while this was disastrous, some of the kind of hyperventilating about it missed the fact that, you know, the Paris Accord, of course, in and of itself was simply not sufficient for where we need to go. And that the kind of technocratic models weren't working either. Can you kind of set that up for us?
Sure. So I think, as you say, there was a lot of concern about Trump's decision to withdraw from Paris and, you know, that this was a sign that, you know, I mean, it was just another sort of one of the catastrophic decisions that Trump was going to make that was going to mean that there was no hope of addressing climate change and so on. And I think, you know, while it's not a good sign, I think it was, the response was overblown in terms of how much our commitment to the Paris Accord was actually going to be addressing climate change on the scale necessary, which many people had pointed out even at the time that, you know, it's good that there's finally an agreement, but it was not nearly sufficient for the for actually taking action in the ways we would need to prevent catastrophic climate change. But then I think also it just demonstrated the limits of trying to negotiate deals of what I think the Obama administration's approach was, which was to either work through domestic policy, but, you know, in a way that could either work through the federal bureaucracy or through executive orders or through elite international negotiations like the various COP meetings, another one of which is actually starting today in Bonn. But so, you know, you can do some work through these kinds of like more technocratic solutions that don't require a mass movement. But I think that they hit their limits when you haven't actually done the work to build political support for a climate program. And when it becomes, you know, an easy target for someone like Trump, who, you know, I think actually what Trump did was just, I think in the same way that a lot of liberals were quick to say, oh, look at all the action Obama's taking on climate, and pointing to these, whether the Paris Accord or the Clean Power Plan or things that, you know, were a step in the right direction, but not really action on the scale we'd need. Trump did the opposite, which is say, look, Obama is killing coal. Obama is killing your jobs to people where, you know, the decline of not only fossil fuel industry, but, you know, industry in general has been really catastrophic, and which actually Obama was not as responsible for.
Let's get to that in just a minute, because I want you to elaborate on that. And that kind of opens up the door of the of addressing the conflict, the false conflict, but nonetheless, the kind of the public, the notion that there's a conflict between workers' rights and progress and a radical environmental agenda. which I think is at the heart of, you know, your argument in a lot of ways. But before we get there, can you just explain briefly why, first of all, why Paris was scientifically, you know, insufficient? It wasn't, this is not just like a political claim you're making. It was not sort of in accordance with where the overwhelming body of science says we need to go. And then maybe to elaborate a bit more on those two-tier Obama tracks and how that reflects kind of what's still put on the table by, you know, like a Macron or a Trudeau, this sort of top-down technocratic version.
Yeah, so the agreements that different countries, or the commitments that different countries had made in the Paris Accord, in terms of their carbon reduction plans and commitments, added up, fell short of what scientists have agreed would be necessary to avoid 2 degrees Celsius of warming, which is, you know, generally the baseline that people say is really like the danger mark for really the more catastrophic types of warming. You know, I think some people think that 2 degrees is too high, but the commitments that countries had made were in themselves not actually enough to get to reach that goal. To start off, so that was, you know, I think even on the face of it, people agreed that it was not going to get us all the way there. And then, you know, it was going to require at any point to actually implement, I think, the set of commitments, because countries tend to fall short of their commitments. In practice, it always requires, I think, a lot of would have required action on the ground to actually put in place. But even the commitments themselves, which were non-binding, would be more than we're just, you know, not didn't add up to what scientists generally agree is the, you know, would keep us within a safe amount of warming.
What? And then so then we have Trump coming along and exploiting this division. And it's very paradoxical because on one hand, I mean, and again, I don't want to draw a false equivalency here. There's no doubt that a top-down liberal technocratic approach, of which is absolutely not my politics nor your politics, but it's certainly preferable to a acceleration and an outright denial of reality and exploitation of the issue, which is obviously what, you know, Trump and has been doing, right? So that's, you know, that's clear. And there's also a whole set of, you know, really exploitative industries that are, you know, that the Democrats and the technocrats accommodate, but the Republicans fully acquiesce to. And we need to make these distinctions. Now, that said, the way climate change has been presented and positioned is that instead of an issue that is, in fact, a very class-based one, and also a very one that also reflects a lot of global inequalities in terms of how the effects are distributed along geographic and certainly class lines, so that if we were really addressing it in a kind of broad-based, democratic, socialistic way, there would be a lot of broad benefits for people that wouldn't be this sort of in the realm of these very abstracted conversations that climate change seems to take place on right now. Because it seems like the way climate change is in positioned is that there's people who fly to international meetings and they're, you know, elite people who go to summits and they care about these abstract targets. And they're not even doing a sufficient job even in those terms. And then, you know, the Donald Trumps of the world make their hucksterish sell for, you know, jobs and, you know, putting those things into opposition. Can you explain where your position kind of comes in of like the actual approach to deal with climate is the future of work. It's also the future of leisure, and neither the demagoguery of Trump nor the top downness of the technocrats are going to get us there.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I totally agree that obviously Trump is sort of, as in many policies, is you know, represents a, it's not kind of just both sides are bad or something. Trump is a, I think, quite horrifying turn towards complete rejection of science. Now, like banning people who work for the EPA from talking about climate change, like a really, you know, turn towards taking up this, you know, fossil fuel industry propagated lie that climate change is not a real thing, right, and so on. But I do think that, as with many policies, it's also, it does illustrate the limits of the Obama administration's approach and sort of people in that camp's approach to the issue is, and I think the extent to which the debate has gotten stuck in, as you say, these sort of abstract targets, but especially the do you believe in climate change or not? And if you do, you do, there's not even a clear sense of what you do. You just sort of support climate action, or it's all about do you believe in it or not?
It's a signifier.
And, you know, we should, and we should be, you know, emphatic that the science is clear and so on. It really is, and it's really pretty clearly because fossil fuel companies have really pushed the sort of like, you know, the question of like the debate over the science, that it continues to be a debate. So we shouldn't cede ground on that. But at the same time, I think that recognizing that people need to have an actual, we need to have a vision of taking action on climate change that isn't just, you know, scolding people about not believing in science or pointing to some really technical chart or abstract commitment that has no connection to people's lives and the ways that they would like them to be better. And so I think the places that the environmental movement and trying to build a more mass movement or connect beyond sort of self-described environmentalists has always gotten hung up on these issues of jobs and consumption, I guess you would put it, where people, there's either a sense that, you know, environmental protection comes at the expense of jobs or at the expense of people's consumption and sort of by extension quality of life. And so this idea that, that a environmentally sustainable future is an austere or job killing one where people suffer for the environment. And I think we really need to reject that narrative and on both the terms of what, on both fronts, so both regarding jobs and regarding people's sort of expectations for the quality of their life, and by reframing the way that we think about both, you know, what jobs are, what work is, and what it means to, you know, have a good life.
So dig into that a little bit more, like specifically in terms of some of the issues that we're dealing and maybe also just add, I think it's not just that it's an austere future. It's an austere future for many, but it's also a very, you know, how did the environment become like an upper middle class issue? Like it's sort of like on one hand, like, well, there's all these people that are going to need to keep living really simple lives because obviously we can't have the Chinese consuming like us because then we're done. But then on the other hand, the job of affluent people in the West is to kind of like, you know, it's just to make all of our iPhones and our, you know, highly consumptive lifestyles just carbon neutral. So there is a kind of weird, you know, there's a problematic class dimension to it as well. So I guess, how did it become perceived as this upper class issue? And then specifically, when we talk about increasing quality of life, increasing jobs, increasing leisure time, what's the climate environmental manifesto for that?
Yeah. I think a lot of the there have been versions of a sort of this tension around environment jobs for a long time, but I do think that, and as the environmental movement, as we know it today, arose in the 70s, it really, there was a moment of, I think, a real fracturing between the environmental and labor movements. And in part, that was because I think the recession in the 70s, the oil crisis, which was not actually about a shortage of energy, but, you know, exacerbated an existing productivity slowdown, exacerbated a recession, and made it seem like there was this real sort of zero-sum game of, jobs and environment, and that you could blame job loss on the increased environmental regulation, which was actually much more about, companies outsourcing jobs and overseas and right. And attempting to escape a more militant labor movement and so on. And so you but, you know, where they were able to, companies are able to exploit environmentalism and environmental regulation as, you know, the scapegoat for why jobs are, you know, leaving the country, why jobs are harder to find. And so I think that that was, I mean, actually, you know, a lot of environmental pollution also got outsourced mm-hmm. along with like the factories and jobs. You know, I think at this time people and environmental consciousness that was pretty strong in the 60s and 70s and was also connected to, you know, various environmental, like what we would today call environmental justice struggles around, you know, pollution and working class areas and so on, but has become, I think, you know, in the through like the 80s and 90s became more partisan in that it was kind of associated with a democratic or like liberal middle class position, but less radical and not seen as something that was about, you know, cleaner and safer environments for people who live near factories or in sites of extraction or things like that. Although, you know, at the same time, I think there's been a lot of really important work on environmental justice over the past several decades. And so the, you know, I also, you know, want to push back on the it's just a middle class issue, because I think in many ways that's, I mean,
it's how it's been publicly
framed,
I think, less so than the truth.
Yeah.
I think that that's just kind of more the way it's been positioned. But you, now, just as we sort of move in the last couple of minutes here, though, do you get specifically, though, into how this would look? And I want to really get more into more of these specifics. You talk about something called Canada's Leap Manifesto, which was, and I'm quoting you now, is a document produced by a cluster of labor, environmental, and indigenous groups. The manifesto advocates in plain terms for an economy centered on caring for one another and caring for the planet. That would mean working less time for higher wages, spending the time we saved with our loved ones and communities, and orienting the work we do towards ending racial and gender inequality, generating energy without destroying ecosystems, and creating ownership structures that return wealth to people and communities rather than extracting it from them. This is the type of model that can ground, you know, greening our cities, creating civilian conservation corps, like you mentioned that we had during the New Deal and expanding them, mass public transit, reclaiming wealth in the form of collective ownership of enterprises. Is this the type of fusion you're talking about? And how does that look in terms of how movements can integrate today to make that happen?
Yeah, so I think the Leap Manifesto is a really fascinating and great document, you know, produced, it's a Canadian manifesto produced by a group of, or a coalition of labor, environmental, and indigenous groups. And I think it's really a very interesting model. It's trying to put forth a vision of a different kind of economy, different kinds of work, and a different, you know, vision for what we want our lives to be like, that takes a lot of cues from, you know, I think socialist feminist thinking around what people call social reproduction, which is, you know, about how the work that it takes to make daily life I mean, both possible and ideally good and, you know, pleasurable and enjoyable. And so I think that this is both, this is where the sort of imperative to rethink jobs and what kinds of, you know, how we can have good work for people that's not in tension with the environment, and also good lives that aren't, you know, excessively resource intensive, comes together. So that in a way that recognizes that the kinds of work that we need more of are actually the kinds of work that are growing in places like the U.S., which are like things like care work, education, work that is, you know, oriented towards people, making people's lives better, towards doing things that people want and need, that doesn't consume huge amounts of resources, or, you know, generate huge amounts of carbon emissions. And which I think, you know, is really also a lot of political potential in places like the U.S. where a growing percentage of the working class actually is already doing that kind of work.
Yeah, that's to be really clear about that. These are the jobs, you know, to use that cliche, these are the jobs of the future regardless. You can go to any, you know, quote unquote mainstream representation of the future of employment and how much of the economy will jobs in all aspects of the service sector be, whether we're talking about being, you know, working in as a doctor or a nurse or a yoga teacher or, you know, someone in some type of sales. Like, these types of professions are what is going to be created to the extent there is formal job creation in late stage capitalist economy. So the question is not whether those jobs will be in the kind of cluster you're talking about. The question is will be how will they be organized, whether people can make a living out of them, and whether they're to actually benefit community or just another source of, you know, narrow profit extraction for capital.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think it's, you know, how can those jobs be jobs that are oriented towards the things people, you know, actually both want to be doing and, you know, providing some kinds of services that people actually need. And I think as that's where all of the, you know, job growth projections are currently. And yet there's a lot of those jobs are currently underpaid, ununionized, really challenging, and I think often underrecognized as like real work or important work. That's why I think organizing that kind of work in new ways and in ways that is, you know, where we should also, I think, as with other kinds of work, want to do like less of it and distribute it broadly and have plenty of time for leisure and you know, spending time doing things other than work, but also recognize that there are kinds of work that are about making, you know, the work of daily life, not just a matter of survival, but of you know, living a good life, of not just sort of getting through the day, but having, you know, like in a public sense, like spaces of a, you know, of leisure that's collective, of communal luxury, of recreation and art and culture, and all of the things we actually like really, I think, value in our lives and don't probably get enough of, and that are also part of, I think, a vision of how we can have, you know, an economy and work for people that is not, that's not environmentally destructive.
Well, Alyssa Battistoni, the piece is Living, Not Just Surviving. It's in the Jacobin. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me.
Thank you. Okay, everybody. I just, before we get to the fun half, and the number is 646-257-3920, I'm going to turn on the IMs now. It's voting day tomorrow in a couple parts of the country, and I'm going to give you from they're all necessary, and I'm going to go in descending order from most to least exciting. But the first one is highly specific. If you live in the 35th district in New York City, in Brooklyn, Jabari Brisport is running an incredible campaign.
He's got a Green New Deal.
He's running as a DSA candidate. He's running as a Green candidate, which I have no problem with on a local level.
No,
New York
great.
City is exactly the type of place where we do live in a one-party town. And whether it's through going in the party on the left and doing DSA affiliated or running as an independent or a Green or a socialist or primarily affiliating with working families, I mean, this town needs a serious injection of unapologetic radical politics. And Jabari's running on serious, I mean, the housing crisis and inequality is obviously the defining issue of the day. Gentrification, of course, racial abuse and policing. I would go check out Jabari Brisport. I mean, I can't, you know, speak as sort of freely on this show as mine, but I mean, I'm certainly voting for him. And
me too.
Yes. And incredibly excited about his race. And people should go check out Jabari Brisport in New Jersey. You know, Phil Murphy, look, he's a former Goldman guy. That's obviously not remotely a strike in his favor, but he's actually running. I mean, first of all, you know, we need, that's a practical one. You need a Democrat back in that mansion, especially with Menendez on the verge of maybe being removed. So making sure a Democrat keeps that Senate seat is what's going to, you know, stave off potentially another push to destroy healthcare. And it's also going to be an important part of not, you know, this new, of course, massive wealth upward, wealth redistribution that the Republican tax plan is. So we need that. And then for what it's worth, Murphy is actually campaigning on a state bank for low interest, like in public interest loans and the Dakota model, which would be great. He's all in on a $15 living wage. And he's actually running a pretty solidly progressive campaign of the, you know, of the centrist mainstream variety. But, you know, that is certainly a vast improvement over Chris Christie and Chris Christie's successor. So let's take care of business and get Phil Murphy elected as governor of New Jersey.
I wrote in my ballot for that man, and I think Wisniewski challenging him in the primary definitely pulled him left, and that's what we need going
forward. That's exactly what we need going forward, and he seemed to be. Now, look, Virginia, Ralph Northam, you know, look, in the long term, Democrats need to stop putting up these kind of candidates. He actually has a few things going for him. Look up his record on schools, his critique of Betsy DeVos. He's actually well to the left of Barack Obama on those types of, on education issues, privatization, and so on. He's made some of the right noises on the environment and healthcare. He made the sanctuary cities comment disgusting, stupid, deplorable, probably not even in a kind of narrow sense politically necessary. But Ed Gillespie, but this is the one where it's like people need, again, this dumb position, it just doesn't work. It doesn't, there's no strategy behind it. And if the experience of Donald Trump being president and how much the spectrum has been pulled and the fact that so much energy is being fought not to expand the field to the left and not in that long-term win of a socialism over barbarism, but just basically to maintain some decent technocratic centrism and try to not fully pull the world into full neo-authoritarian oligarchy, which I know we were already there, but if you can't recognize that this is a massive pull further, then you're just not being real. And Ed Gillespie is the worst of all worlds. He is running a Trump-style, incredibly bigoted and xenophobic campaign, which Republicans will replicate across the country. And that will mean practically more incidents of hate, more racially motivated crimes. It will mean more attacks on people, you know, supporting the terror campaign that this administration is implementing against immigrant communities. And then on top of it, Ed Gillespie's running as a Trump Republican, and he's also a Bush Republican. So his background is as, you know, a Republican Party figure who raised money from every type of despicable corporate interest you can imagine. He is going to be a governor who, when redistricting comes up, will write districts that favor Republicans, which is very dangerous, obviously, moving forward, and non-democratic. He will absolutely push an agenda that is a pure 1% agenda that will hurt the vulnerability, that will hurt anybody in Virginia that is poor or gay or of color or transgender. He'll have a relentless war against them. And
also black.
Also black. Don't forget the blacks, the original people to terrorize. And the, you know, I mean, I guess the other original people we terrorized, we killed all of them. I don't even know if they're in Virginia. So, you know, this is the classic move that, you know, there was a better candidate in the primary of Perriello. He lost. Now, do you go and expend a little bit of your time to vote for the better and by the way, like for all of Northam's flaws, like the clear, the vastly better, the worth a couple minutes of your fucking time better candidate? Or, you know, do you shoot yourself and many other people in the foot by letting a incredibly unethical, massive sleaze running a xenophobic campaign and an old style corporate Tammany Bush Republican be elected governor of Virginia. It's a no brainer. I'm sorry. This isn't difficult. Definitely go vote for Ralph Northam. And you wanted to say this is a,
yeah,
this
there's
is important
a,
there, too.
It's sort of, this sort of sprung up, following the, Cy Vance revelations, Mark Fleedner. He's a guy, he seems really good. The DSA sort of, I don't know if officially endorsed him, but I know a bunch of DSA people I know have been trying to pump him. So if you live in Manhattan, Mark Fleedner, write in for, DA.
Yes. Every place that is a one-party D-town, they you should be going after them on all fronts. And if you're in a one-party Republican town, I'd take over your local Democratic apparatus or whatever. Create a new one. I don't think it really matters. But
either or, as long as you're doing something.
Either or, as long as you're doing something. But the, but on gubernatorial races like in New Jersey and Virginia, get out there, vote D. And I think you could also, you could literally send a tweet that criticizes the Democratic Party and their utter whackness on the same day that you vote for one of those candidates. You're, it, it's this amazing thing called multitasking. We, tomorrow on my show, on the Michael Brooks Show, I'm hosting Benjamin Dixon and ContraPoints, and then Netha Khan will be in studio for postgame. This past weekend, the primer was on CLR James, Trinidadian, Marxist theorist, historian Arthur Black Jacobins. And if you go and if you've subscribed to Michael Brooks Show on iTunes, we have an unlocked post game. We have an unlocked history of Silicon Valley fascism. And if in order to get the whole thing, which over 760 of you have done, which is amazing, and we're going to continue to grow, go to patreon.com/TMBS. We will be right back, everybody. Hey, folks, don't forget one search on tripping.com lets you filter and compare and sort over 10 million available properties on trusted sites like VRBO, TripAdvisor, Booking.com, and more. Don't wonder if you're getting the best deal on that New Year's Eve cabin or winter beach vacation. Save an average of 18% per night by booking with Tripping.com. Bottom line, to save time and money while booking the perfect vacation rental, head to Tripping.com/majority today. That's TRIPPING.com/majority.